My clicker seems to be weak this morning, so I may have to call on help from the booth. I begin this morning with some comments that a commentator on the Minor Prophets makes. he notes that Old Testament prophets sometimes did very strange things, and of course, while in Hosea it will be a different thing, nevertheless, it is strange what Hosea is asked to do, or it would be for us to be asked to do what he did. And there are several examples of that, but for instance, Isaiah is commanded to walk naked and barefoot, and that would be the way a prisoner of war would be marched in a parade. For 3 years, I looked at this a second time. 3 years is a long time to go publicly naked. But it was a signal, a sign that the Egyptians would be led away in just that way as captives by the Assyrians. The people to whom Hosea prophesied would be led away in captivity as well by the Assyrians, but particularly Isaiah was speaking to the situation of the Egyptian. Jeremiah, again at God's command, carried a yoke on his shoulder for several months to indicate that any nation that would bring its neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon would be spared. Those who resisted would not. And there are two chapters, 27 and 28, that tell that story in Jeremiah. Ezekiel, like a little boy, is instructed to play war. The wording, of course, in Scripture is not play war, but essentially he is told to do on, I think specifically, it's a mud brick to depict the siege of Jerusalem. That's chapter 4, the first 8 verses of Ezekiel. So indeed, well, our young people have games today, Battleship and other things of playing war. So essentially that's what Ezekiel is told to do. Obviously that's a sign of the destruction of Jerusalem. Later on, his wife dies suddenly, and he's commanded not to mourn. And then after that, he's instructed to preach to the people that they should not mourn either in times to come when their sons and their daughters would fall by the sword in the coming destruction. That's chapter 24. Well, what is all this about? Okay. Yes. Okay. One commentator on the prophets has suggested that the peculiar things that that previous writer was talking about actually were acts of mercy, that God's people, for instance, had become deaf to God's voice, no longer paying attention to his words, and so God called his prophets to do strange things. We might call them action sermons in hopes that the people would wake up and listen. Maybe that makes sense to me, perhaps to you. I'm afraid we at times are deaf to the messages that come from the Lord, and it would be good for something to shock us, to wake us up and listen. It would be debatable whether Hosea's situation was as difficult as Isaiah's or Jeremiah's or whatever, but it is true, I think, that what we're dealing with in the book of Hosea is an action sermon for the people, mainly of the northern kingdom, but he speaks also at times to those in the southern kingdom. He's instructed to marry a woman. Commentators differ on this. Is he told to marry a prostitute, woman who's already a prostitute, or is he told to marry a woman who becomes later a prostitute? I am inclined, we'll talk about this more later, to think that she becomes unfaithful at a later time. But this is the beginning of the story. She bore him 3 children. In particular, the latter two, he's not sure, were actually his children. She left him for another man, and ultimately he had the humiliating responsibility of buying his wife back. Well, this is a vivid picture of what the people of Israel had done to their God by prostituting themselves to idols and committing spiritual adultery, I think is a term that fits well with Hosea. And on the other side, I think it teaches us some very, very important lessons about the nature of our God, the God of Israel, that they were disobeying and grieving. In other words, God's response to all this is an important part of the message of Hosea. Okay, in our Bible, the order is beginning with Hosea. This is the first of what, for a long, long time, I guess we've called the minor prophets. Minor not in significance or importance, but minor in the sense that their messages are much more brief than, say, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and other books. By the way, I just picked up one of my Bibles randomly and found the beginning of the minor prophets and then the last page, and I counted in that Bible 62 pages. Well, I did the same for Isaiah, and Isaiah covers 75 pages. So just Hosea is smaller. I'm sorry, the total of the 12 prophets is smaller space-wise than the prophet Isaiah. The title of the book, The Word of the Lord That Came to Hosea, that's a pattern we'll see in many of the prophets, particularly the minor prophets. It's like saying Hosea is God's prophet, the word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri. Well, that identifies him as an Old Testament prophet, and again, follows a pattern that we can see elsewhere. There's very little information for us to know about Hosea, and even less of his father, Beeri. Is just mentioned, and that's all we know. Hosea is the author, and also, when we begin to look at the book, he's, in a real sense, the main character. The meaning of his name is virtually the same as that of Joshua or of Jesus. You remember the story of the 12 tribes back in Numbers 13. In verse 8, we're told that from the tribe of Ephraim that Moses chose Hoshea, the son of Nun. And then in verse 16, we're told that Moses called Hoshea Joshua. A little difference there. Hoshea, he saves. Joshua, more like Yahweh or Jehovah, saves. Why would that be so? Well, one suggestion would be that Moses is recognizing ahead of time the faith of Joshua. He was one of the two Yes We Can spies that went into the wilderness. In Matthew 1:21, you should call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. The setting is the northern kingdom, and very likely specifically Ephraim. When we get to chapter 4 and verse 17, Hosea begins to call the people that he's specifically prophesying to Ephraim. He's talking about Israel, of course, but beginning there about a third of the way through the book, he begins to call them Ephraim. And he does that then 31 times before the end of the book. Okay, he does address the people of the northern kingdom primarily, but there are times when he does speak to the people of Judah, the southern kingdom. One of the indications, however, that he lived in the northern kingdom is chapter 7, verse 5. He refers to the king there as our king. If indeed he's from the north, and I think surely he is, this is just a kind of aside, that makes him the second with Jonah, the only writing prophets from the northern kingdom. Lots of prophets, but not all writing prophets. I'm going to take some time here to talk about how the kingdoms came to be divided. And I don't do this just to take some time to talk about history, because what happens in the creation of the northern kingdom has to do very much with the religious practices in the north, and those are key, of course, to the book itself. So I'm going to do some reading here. If you choose to read directly from your Bible, I know that this may be a little bit awkward, but in some places I think we tell the story better if I just read it rather than try to explain it all. 1 Kings chapter 11 and 12 basically tell the story. How did 12 tribes in the end become two kingdoms? Okay, going back to 1 Kings, we're told Solomon loved many foreign women, and when he was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. For Solomon went after the Ashtoreth. This is a term we'll want to remember when we talk about the practices that Hosea is concerned about in the northern kingdom. Several names, but Ashtoreth will be one of them. Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Amorites. Then Solomon built a high place. A high place is another term that I'm probably telling you things that you already know, but nevertheless, it's one of the terms we'll want to remember as we work through the book. He built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. And so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrificed to other gods. That's chapter 11, first 8 verses. Picking up after that, in punishment, God raised up enemies or adversaries for King Solomon. And there's more than one, but we'll talk particularly about one. But first of all, verse 11, therefore the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your practice, and you've not kept my covenant and my statutes that I've commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant, one of those adversaries. Yet for the sake of David your father, I will not do it in your days, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of David my servant and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. Well, more than one, at least three or four adversaries, but Jeroboam clearly is the first. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And I note here that while he's not called Jeroboam the first, he will be for what we're concerned about, because one of his descendants is king when Hosea begins his prophecy. So we need to distinguish between the first and the second. Verse 28, the man Jeroboam was very able. And when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he gave him charge over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. And at that time, when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, the prophet Ahijah, the Shilonite, found him on the road. And Ahijah had dressed himself in a new garment, and the two of them were alone in the open country. Then Ahijah laid hold of the new garment that was on him and tore it into 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces, for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I am about to tear the kingdom from the hand of Solomon and will give you the 10 tribes. Parenthetically, but he shall have one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city that I have chosen out of the tribes of Israel, because they have forsaken me and worship again Ashtoreth, the goddess of Sidonians, Chemosh, Milcom, and so forth, and they have not walked in my ways, doing what is right in the sight in my sight and keeping my statutes and my rules, as David his father did. And again, nevertheless, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him ruler all the days of his life. This is the descendant, the replacement for Saul, I'm having a senior moment here, the next king in Judah. But I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand and give it to you, 10 tribes. Yet to his son I will give one tribe, that David my servant may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem. And you shall be king of Israel. Okay, when Solomon died, it's Rehoboam and Solomon I was trying to think of. Rehoboam begins to reign. Jeroboam, in exile in Egypt, because Solomon, of course, understood that he was an adversary by that time. Jeroboam at the same time returns, and he and the people come to Rehoboam with this offer. Your father made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. And Rehoboam says, I'll consider an answer in 3 days. In the meantime, he asked the old men, and they said, be a servant to the people, and they will be your servants forever. But he also asked the young men, and they say, my little finger is thicker than my father's thighs. My father chastened you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. Old men can be something other than wise. Sometimes I recognize that all of us old men are not wise, but I think all of us thinking about this take a lesson that there are advantages that come with age and experience that sometimes are good. Rehoboam took the wrong side, answered as the young men advised. And so the division, beginning verse 16 of 1 Kings 12. And when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, what portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now look to your own house, David. So Israel went to their tents, but Rehoboam reigned over the people of Israel who live in the cities of Judah. So that's in the south. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day, the time of writing. And when all Israel heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel in the north. There was none that followed the house of David, but the tribe of Judah only. This is one of the difficult things, I think, in this history. The next two verses actually refer to the house of Judah and the house of Benjamin in previous times because of a terrible thing that happened in Benjamin. The tribe was almost wiped out, and with effort from the other tribe, they were populated again, but this is one of the things I have to be careful with and note. On the one hand, the house of David is the tribe of Judah only, but there are Benjamites included in that as well, but that's the southern kingdom. When we look at what Jeroboam begins in the north, then we get some understanding of what is certainly a major beginning, if not the very first of the beginnings of worship practices in the north that Hosea is directly connected with. After Jeroboam becomes king, he built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim. That's his capital at that point, and lived there. And it's noted that he went out and built Penuel, among other things. But as he looked at the situation, he said in his heart, now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David if I leave things alone. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn again to their Lord, to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So the king took counsel and made 2 calves of gold. He will place one of those in Bethel and the other in Dan. we'll want to locate those on a map in a moment. But places of worship, it's not all that far from Shechem to Jerusalem, and Bethel is very close to Jerusalem. But he realizes that's in the other kingdom. If we allow if I allow them to go worship there, then my kingdom is lost. When he made two calves of gold, he said to the people, "You have gone up to Jerusalem long enough." So that's a signal that this new religion he's devising will be one of convenience. "Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." I've noted that these are the same words that Aaron used when he built the golden calf back in Exodus 32. Verse 29 says, "And he set one up in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan." And then reading on, "Then this thing became a sin, for the people went as far as Dan to become one," to be before one. They are spread apart, as we'll see on the map. Many would have gone to Bethel, but some would have gone as far as Dan, and Dan is a far piece. He also made temples on high places, should be plural, and appointed priests from among all the people who were not of the Levites. Okay, temple on the high places, when we look at the practice of worship of Baal, then high places are the occasion, the location for Baal worship and other kinds of worship. When he appoints priests, he appoints from more than one tribe and not from the tribe of Levi, if he follows the plan of Moses. He appoints a feast that is similar to a feast from the Old Testament, but it's at a different time and a different place. And he himself offers sacrifices rather than the sacrifices being offered by priests. So note this. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves he had made, the golden calves. He went up to the altar that he made in Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, a change in time, in the month he had devised in his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the people of Israel and went up to the altar to make offerings again, he himself offering. Okay, just kind of summarizing here, he replaces Jerusalem with Dan and Bethel. He appoints priests who are not from the right tribe according to God's instruction. He invented a feast that's like one of the feasts of the Old Testament, but it's done in a different place and in a little bit different time. The Feast of Tabernacles would have been done in the 7th month, Leviticus chapter 23, but Jeroboam will make it the 8th month. This is kind of an aside, but you may have had an experience like this. When we lived in Valparaiso, Indiana, we lived on the end of a block, and the house owned by the church was the full width of that end of the block, two streets coming in, but close together there. I could look out our kitchen, big kitchen window, and look down the block most of the way and see the patios, the backyards of houses facing the two different directions. Three or four houses down was a house where a Jewish family lived. So in the early fall, at the time that the Feast of Tabernacles would take place, they would pull the plywood sheets out of their garage, stand them up, connect them, go somewhere and cut tree limbs and put on the top. I never was brave enough to go ask, do you actually sleep in your tabernacle at night? I don't know specifically what they did as far as using it, but every fall, faithfully, they did that, and I could see everything but seeing inside. That's the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, Jeroboam keeps that, but in his place in a little different time. Okay, if I read through from where we are about chapter 11 or 12 of 1 Kings, and I continue reading on through 1 Kings and on into 2 Kings, Jeroboam's false worship will be referred to quite often in that reading. And this new worship at his making is a characteristic of the sin for which the people would go into exile at a later time. And in fact, Hosea himself apparently will live to very close to this point, and that will be about 722 B.C. We'll talk more about dates a little later. It was a little harder for me to locate slides without buying slides, I found out. Some things have been available online free that no longer are. So this is not going to be very helpful. And I don't have a red marker to show you, but a couple of things to remember. Ephraim is in the light to blue or purple there on the left side. Just below it, kind of a tan color, is Benjamin. This is a representation of the original lot allotments for the 12 tribes. Dan in kind of orange color to the left. As I recall, Dan was never successful in taking over their allotment, so eventually they moved to the far north. So this is from the very beginning. But if we could see this better, from Benjamin in that small area of tan, forgive my color recognition there, would be Bethel, because Bethel is originally in Benjamin. When we look at later maps, particularly the division of the kingdom, Bethel will be in the northern kingdom. And, of course, that's one of the prime sites for worship. Okay, this is not too helpful except to just in a broad sense compare the northern kingdom. It'll fall to Assyria in 722. The southern kingdom lasts longer. Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, the final part of the conquest in 586 B.C. But we've already been talking about northern, southern kingdom, and, of course, this is the sort of thing we're looking at. Okay, and this one still kind of blurry probably for you, but under Israel, northern kingdom, little to down and to the left is Bethel. I don't find Dan until almost the very top of the screen, and so that's what Jeroboam did. I can't let them go back to Jerusalem, so I'll do one in the south, Bethel, and one in the north. And so that phrase, whatever it was, as far as Dan, something to that effect, it is a long ways up to Dan. And I included this one, doesn't add much more, except this is proposes to be a map at the time of 2 Kings. And for that matter, will be more or less the time of Hosea. Okay, dating things, you already know, I'm sure, that Old Testament prophets dated their ministries by the reigning kings. Hosea is actually from the north, I believe, but he does pay some attention to what's happening in the south. Some of the same sins are going on in Judah in the south, but they are not as far along as the northern kingdom. But he dates himself in terms of Judean kings, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah. I don't think Hosea lives through the full life of Hezekiah, but Hezekiah is still reigning when Hosea probably dies. The king right at the time that Hosea will begin his prophecy will be the second Jeroboam, son of Joash. Jeroboam's last year is about 753, so Hosea must begin his work a little before then. Hezekiah would be in the southern kingdom. He lives to 687, so Hosea doesn't live that long, but Hezekiah is king in the south before Hosea is finished. Okay, this would mean from 753, this is B.C., of course, until the northern kingdom is taken captive by Assyria. From 753 to 722, there are six kings in the north. Four of them are assassinated by their successors, so some of them reign for a very short time. Obviously, that's chaos, and we don't see all of that in Hosea, but that's taking place as Hosea is prophesying. I think the significant thing in all of this is that Hosea is doing his work at a time, at a most turbulent time, and the end time for the kingdom of Israel. Okay, just to, we've talked about how the northern kingdom, how the kingdoms were divided. Helpful, I think, to ask, okay, when was that date-wise? Well, Jeroboam the first, 924 to 903. Jeroboam the second, who dies shortly after Hosea begins his work, his dates would be something like 782 to 753. So it's at least more than 150 years between the division of the kingdoms and the work of Hosea. Okay, we will close here soon and pick up at this point. Before we do, just a couple of words. I think there are two different themes we could give to Hosea. They're connected, but from different sides. We could say his theme is God's steadfast love. It's a particular word that's translated different ways, sometimes loving kindness, sometimes mercy. But obviously, a major theme is God's steadfast love for Israel, despite the fact that she is unfaithful. Hosea instructed to marry a certain woman and experience with her a married life that is a dramatization of the sin and unfaithfulness of Israel. But that's a rich metaphor for the themes of the book, sins, judgment, and mercy. And then in particular, the unfaithfulness. Through the book, Israel will be called a promiscuous wife, an indifferent mother, an illegitimate child, an ungrateful son, a stubborn heifer, a silly dove, luxuriant vine, and grapes in the wilderness. We may have difficulty working out the meaning of all of those, but Hosea uses all of those. Okay, we had a few more to go through. We'll pick up there next time and actually get into the text in chapter 1. Thank you for your patience.